My title is De Sitter Space and the Lambda N Correspondence, I think. I understand that I'm supposed to open our De Sitter theme for this week, and Tom Banks will be giving us a talk on Thursday on his insights into the subject. So I hope he'll forgive me if I start by taking a line from his recent paper in which he quotes an old country and western song that that goes, "De Sitter Space is a lonely place." And I feel that that's true in more than one sense. There haven't been a lot of people that worked on it. And I hope that perhaps what will come out of this week's talks is that people will get interested in the space-time and will give it their well-deserved attention. And perhaps we'll make some progress on understanding quantum gravity in it. All right, so let me tell you why I think we should be interested in De Sitter space. And this is very much an open list, so the audience is invited to contribute. One good reason is that we may well live there. Recent cosmological observations indicate that a large part of the energy density in the universe is vacuum energy. If that is really a fixed cosmological constant, then in the far future, all ordinary matter will have been diluted away, and we have only vacuum energy, in which case we will be living in something that locally looks like De Sitter space. And in fact, it looks like this vacuum energy has already taken over and started to dominate the evolution of the universe. Well, that depends on how optimistic you are. So in that case, you know, that should be a pretty strong motivation for understanding the space-time. Another good reason is that it's a very simple space-time in some sense. Namely, it is a maximally symmetric manifold, along with Minkowski space, which is flat, and ADS space, which is negatively curved. De Sitter space is the maximally symmetric, positively curved space-time. So ADS and Minkowski got a lot of attention, so maybe it's time that we give some to De Sitter. Another reason why we might be interested is that De Sitter space has a horizon. It's a weird kind of horizon because it's observer-dependent. But generally, we've found it fruitful to study horizons for understanding quantum gravity. And perhaps the De Sitter horizon will allow us to make some progress in that direction. Another reason might be the relative paucity of non-supersymmetric and/or cosmological solutions to M theory that have been found so far. That is, to some extent, perhaps a drawback so far of our understanding of M theory. And the hope may be that De Sitter space is sufficiently simple that it may offer us a way in, open the door to these problems. So. All right. Now, another reason that you may actually consider a reason not to study De Sitter space, but one can put a positive spin on it, is the fact that we have no microscopic theory for it right now, which is sort of related to what I said before, which, of course, is a great opportunity.
We don't even have a macroscopic embedding in string theory.
Right. Presumably, if we had one, then we wouldn't we understand from string theory the microscopic description?
Well, I mean, we had macroscopic embeddings of black holes in string theory from day one.
And right. So that's right. It's worse than just the fact that we don't have a microscopic description. Yeah, that's right. You know, this is an opportunity. As far as I can see, there are two possibilities. Either we just haven't been clever enough, and we are in fact able to find a solution in M theory that will enable us to understand De Sitter space microscopically. There's a no-go theorem by Maldacena and Nunez, which excludes this possibility for a certain class of compactifications. But it looks like there's certainly loopholes around this, and some brave souls like Eva, as I understand, are working on the problem of whether maybe you can find a solution to M theory that looks like the Sitter space. Another possibility is that we'll have to find new regions of M theory that are not yet understood or known.
This no-no theorem is based on supervisory or something more?
Sorry?
It's based on gravity, but with certain assumptions, like no three-level cosmological term.
But it's supergravity, really.
It's supergravity without any brains.
Supergravity on you,
but just smooth supergravity.
Yeah. I was wondering what you mean, say, in M theory, as opposed to in supergravity.
Well, although they do allow certain singularities, but there's a time associated with brains that they allow, the one factor of being zero.
Have those kinds of singularities. Yeah. Okay. So it's a little stronger than being absolutely smooth, as I understand it, but it has some strong assumptions.
But the statement is what? There's no non-singular solution. There are no solutions allowing for singularity for the warp factor that's zero, even if you don't include higher derivative terms or the three-level cosmological term. So, for example, in non-critical string theory, you have a
three-level
cosmological term.
But it doesn't rule out things like, for example, if you go near a singular, some kind of collapsing cycle singularity in the club, which were the kinds of things that people were trying to really get
to. Right. So, I certainly would not want to discourage anyone from trying to do this, and it would be, I think, a huge breakthrough if you could find an honest solution. Good. Now suppose that someone came along with a quantum gravity theory of De Sitter space. What are some of the things that we might want to know first? Well, one thing that I would be very interested in is whether the entropy of the observer-dependent horizon in De Sitter space can be understood from a microscopic perspective. There's a statistical understanding of that entropy. I will. Yes. Don't worry. Those are just those. We do, yes. And there's been some progress on these issues by Hawking, Maldacena, and Strominger, and an earlier paper by Maldacena and Strominger, De Sitter space of 2 plus 1 dimensions, I believe. But I don't think we have a very general understanding of this horizon. And another question that I would like to know the answer to is, what are the observables in De Sitter space? Because presumably that might tell me something about what observables are in cosmology in general. What kind of physical processes should we be interested in? What questions should we really ask? Because usually we ask about S matrices or things related to S matrices, and that's very hard to define in De Sitter spacetimes. So all that I can do in this talk, I think, is to try to give you a classical and semi-classical analysis of De Sitter and asymptotically De Sitter spacetimes, and in particular to apply the holographic principle to these spacetimes and see how much can we learn from that, so that maybe we have at least a little bit of information about what we should be shooting for. And one particular point that I will want to make is that there are indications that in De Sitter space, or in fact in all spacetimes with positive cosmological constant, the maximal entropy is bounded essentially by the inverse cosmological constant in Planck units. So you will never be able to observe any more entropy than that. And that's an interesting observation, I think, because it leads you to speculate whether perhaps these classes of spacetimes are described in Hilbert spaces that have only a finite number of states in them. So let me introduce the protagonist, the Sitter space. I already said it's a maximally symmetric solution with positive curvature. It's a solution to Einstein's equations with a positive cosmological constant. The curvature radius is related to that cosmological constant by this formula, one over the square root. the order one numbers that are in here are correct for D equals 4, but in spirit, everything I say, I believe, is correct for higher dimensional visitor spacetimes as well. But just to be specific, I will always talk about D equals 4. So you know what I mean by two-dimensional and three-dimensional. So.
Excuse me, so the previous formula, both the entropy was correct also for four-dimensional. Otherwise, it's different.
It's a different... No, it's not a different power of the lambda, I think. It's a different coefficient on top. Well, I'm sorry. I'm using lambda as in the gravity lambda. The
it's always dimensions length minus.
Yeah.
You're only thinking of lambda as
yeah. The energy energy density lambda. I'm referring to the. Lambda that you put into gravitational action.
I thought that the entropy is proportional to the area of the horizon, which is roughly r to the power of minus 2. Mm-hmm. Right, so
right?
It's 1 over lambda only equals 4.
Can that be right?
So it's certainly true that the area goes like r naught to the d minus 2.
Yeah. But is r naught related to 1 over the square of lambda in higher dimensional spaces?
No, but this, well, you put a formula right there. Dimensions. This is a factor of Newton's constant is the difference.
Yeah.
So just keep Newton's constant proud of the whole island, and lambda has, it's always like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. So, good. So let me write down the metric for de Sitter space, or one of the metrics, which is the one that I want to first talk about. So the metric that covers the spacetime globally. Okay, so that tells you that the spacetime looks like a hyperboloid if I embed it in a higher dimensional space. Namely, time runs from plus to minus infinity, and at infinite, at the in the infinite past and future, the three-sphere space-like sections become exponentially large. But at time zero, you know, they have a size given by r zero. Okay. Now, that I think is a good way to look at de Sitter space globally, if you have that hyperboloid in mind. But an interesting question is, what is the causal structure and the asymptotic structure of de Sitter space? Okay, and to understand that, let me draw a Penrose diagram, which is simply a square. Okay, now let me explain what things are in this diagram. So I've used a conformal rescaling of the metric to compactify time to a finite interval, and to make sure that these three spheres don't become arbitrarily large anymore. So this is really an interval times a three-sphere. Three-sphere is that direction. So time runs from minus infinity to plus infinity in terms of the physical time from here to there. And a three-sphere space-like section in the physical space-time is represented over here. Well, let me first, I've suppressed two dimensions here, so let me recover one dimension first by drawing this three-sphere like that. So it has a north pole and it has a south pole. And it has these two-sphere lines of latitude. Okay. And that three-sphere is represented by a line that goes across like this, where this is the north pole, and this is the south pole. And all these points here are really two spheres. That would be the equator. So a generic point in the interior of this diagram is a two-sphere. Okay. Sometimes you see the Sitter space drawn as a rectangle, sort of twice this square, which is when people don't represent points by two spheres, but by half of a two sphere. particular one plus one dimensional distributed space, you would be likely to draw like that. Is that why you're looking skeptical, Andy?
What happens to the, I usually draw that other diagram. What happens to the past boundary or past light cone when you get to infinity?
So when you get to, I was going to say that. Let me say one more thing before I come to that. So this is you can think of this left line and this right line as just the origins of the polar coordinate, the world lines of the origins of the polar coordinate systems on this three sphere. So these are really world lines. Everything else would be really a world tube. So if we want to think of a point like world line, we really should think of these edges of the square and put ourselves there. These two, the other two edges, the top and bottom, are conformal infinities that I've added in by doing this transformation. So they correspond to past and future infinity, which is where every time like a null line ends. And the fact that these things are space-like has the interesting consequence that an observer in that space-time can never see the entire space-time. Now, if we let our observer live forever, they still just see exactly half of the space-time. And in the hyperboloid, you can think of that as being somehow this region. Okay. This line here is a future event horizon. And in empty de Sitter space, it's always a null hypersurface. In an empty de Sitter space, it has constant cross-sectional spatial area equal to 12 pi over lambda. Good. Now, I want to contrast. This is really one of the, points that I'd like to make in this talk. I want to contrast the asymptotic infinity structure of de Sitter space with that of asymptotically flat space and anti-de Sitter space. So let's draw a conformal diagram for Minkowski space or for anti-de Sitter. Anti-de Sitter just keeps going, so I'm just going to draw part of it. In which case, the conformal infinities are, either this tin can at the boundary or these null infinities. Okay. One consequence of the different infinity structure is that there's no future event horizon in these spacetimes. Another consequence, and that's, I think, the one that I really want to emphasize in this talk, is that in Minkowski space and ADS, once I'm given the infinity structure, I can't destroy it. We do not believe that there's any scattering process I can do in Minkowski space that will make the space-time cease to be asymptotically flat. Yeah, unless you believe in naked singularities. Gary was reminding me about this possibility yesterday, but I don't think we do. So. Basically, once you're given the asymptotic structure of these spacetimes, you're done. You can rely on that always being there, and so it makes sense, for example, to define states near infinity to exploit the fact that interactions turn off there, that the metric takes a universal form, and to think about scattering. You always know that the stuff is going to come back out to infinity. In de Sitter space, this is not so.
If a bubble of takes the case for formation of a bubble event in de Sitter space, does that change the causal structure? So usual vacuum decay.
Oh.
In some sense, look like.
Yeah, I would expect that that will change the causal structure. So if you believe that there's an instability in that sense, then that's right.
But anti de Sitter space can't go anywhere that we know about except for it.
But in the case where you go to anti de Sitter space, it should somehow change you from this diagram to that diagram, so you still have an infinity.
Yeah.
Okay. I assume that you would draw something that consists of pasting together the upper part of the ADS diagram with the lower part of Minkowski, but the bubble gets accelerated out, so it gets to null infinity. So you would expect that this gets removed, but you would still be left with an infinity. At least that much is clear. And in de Sitter space, this is not so. It's very easy, in fact, to come up with physical processes which will, for example, caused there not to be a future infinity of De Sitter space, even though there was a past one. So it's easily possible to find spacetimes that have only one infinity but not the other. You're not guaranteed, having one, that there will be the other one there.
Because of collapse.
Because you can have collapse.
But in Minkowski space, future time-like infinity can get a singularity.
Right, but I don't think we're too worried about that because we don't really need that desperately, do we? I mean, what kind of process do you have in mind? Like a right. So
singular, really, because you can still have observers slip for
it. Right. So if you have a black hole, we believe that the black hole will evaporate and everything will come back out again. So I can still define an out state near. Oh. Right. Right. So I mean, we know that from a classical point of view, you'd expect some pathology here because you would lose information in the black hole. So it's isn't that related to what you're observing?
So what's different about De Sitter space than anything else?
The difference in De Sitter space is that, let me give you an example that will perhaps illustrate it. The point is that the entire space-time collapses in a big crunch. It's not just a local part where you form a black hole, but there's an outside left where you can still sit and make observations. In De Sitter space, you get a big crunch. The entire space-time collapses everywhere. Okay, so there's nothing left. And an example of that would be, think of specifying an initial state on some free sphere in the very far past. So you specify some incredibly dilute, whatever, gas of dust. All right? And you can separate particles very well because these three spheres, you can take them to be arbitrarily large if you just go far enough. Okay. Now there are two possibilities of things that can happen. One possibility is that during the entire evolution of this dust cloud, the energy density of the matter that you've put in always remains much smaller than the energy density of the vacuum. Okay, in which case I can well approximate this process as a background De Sitter space on which some dust particles are moving. The back reaction will be small. Okay, in that case, I would expect that the dust particles come back out here, and there's no back reaction, so I just have the full De Sitter geometry, including the future infinity. But another possibility is that I've put so many dust particles in here that they don't fit through the throat. In other words, at some stage during the collapse of a cloud, the matter energy starts taking over, becomes more important than the vacuum energy density. Okay. And in that case, what you're looking at is a collapsing portion of a closed FRW universe. Forget the vacuum energy. It doesn't play a role anymore. Okay? And we know from Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems that in that case, there's no way out. You're going to have a final singularity. And so I should rather have drawn that space-time like this. Okay, I have De Sitter infinity in the past. Let's draw that as ds minus. But I do not have it in the future. Okay, and just by time reversing that, you can see immediately that I can also do the opposite thing. I can start with a big bang here, and let my matter expand until its density becomes negligible, at which point the vacuum energy takes over, and I get a De Sitter future,
which is
what's happening to us. Exactly. So that's a prime example of something which is only ds plus.
But couldn't we imagine an analogy with what you said about the black hole case, that when the matter gets very singular, quantum effects take over and you have to solve some quantum equation, and it finds its way through that middle point, reconnects up back onto the expanding. And we again end up with
this starting. Well, but I would consider that to be wild speculation right now, because we really have absolutely no control over physics near a space-like future singularity. I think it's qualitatively a very different situation from having just a black hole that you can look at from the outside and waiting for that to evaporate again. you can continue, you continuously have a region of the space-time which is, you know, well-behaved and basically classical.
But there are general arguments that it will evaporate. You're saying, and there, yeah, there's no general
that, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, right. Are you going to charge?
It's essentially the same argument to vote for black hole. Right?
Well, I think the reason why our expectation of unitarity, actually this, well, I was going to come to this point at some, because one of the questions I would really like to know about De Sitter space is whether that temperature and radiation that allegedly comes from the horizon, which I haven't talked about yet, whether that carries information or not, and whether there is a sense of unitarity, at least in asymptotically De Sitter space terms, where I can continue observing. But I think that our arguments in favor of that are a lot weaker than they were in the scattering case in flat space, because in scattering, we had an argument that we didn't want anything to fundamentally change in our theory just because an intermediate state happened to be a black hole. We knew that the theory worked really well as a unitary theory, and so there are good, you know, fundamental reasons to believe that that unitarity is a general principle. In cosmology, we don't even have a setup like that to start with. We don't have an S matrix way of thinking. So it's not clear to me whether these arguments are as convincing there. Good. So the point of this exercise was to illustrate that in De Sitter space, if you have one infinity, you don't necessarily have the other. Yeah, it's very different from these cases, I think. So let me draw a diagram, which I'm going to refer to again and again, basically, and which is whose purpose is to classify space-time with positive cosmological constant under this consideration. So the most special and beautiful one of all of them is exactly De Sitter space. Okay. Then there are spacetimes, which are asymptotically De Sitter, both in the past and in the future. So let me call them ds plus minus. Okay. Good. Then there are spacetimes which are, okay, this is going to be challenging. De Sitter only in the future, or De Sitter only in the past.
Is this sort of reset overlapping that not included in?
Well, so for example, by ds minus, I mean any spacetime that is that has a past De Sitter infinity. So I would like to include as a special case. Yeah, thank you. So that's why I'm drawing them like this. Okay, so they're more and more specialized, so I want to include as special cases the ones that have both infinities. But to go in the other direction, once I'm willing to give up one infinity, it's not clear to me why I shouldn't give up the other one as well, and simply consider all lambda greater than zero universes. That's still a restriction. I mean, I'm implicitly, you know, assuming that we've picked once and for all a positive value of lambda. There are perfectly fine lambda greater than zero universes which never look like De Sitter space. For example, a closed universe that starts and ends in a Big Bang and Big Crunch, where the universe doesn't expand far enough for the vacuum energy to have a chance to dominate. In that case, it just behaves like any old closed universe. Okay. So this is the sort of class of spacetimes that I'd like to be looking at. And I will make arguments in this talk which will basically say that if I take a global point of view of these spacetimes and I look at entropy on global space-like slices, then I'm able to make the statement that the entropy of all of these spacetimes, the ones that are sort of both in the past and the future, is less than 3 pi over lambda. But if I take a point of view where I'm interested only in the information that any one observer can actually gain, and any experiment that can actually be made in a causal way, then I will be able to derive this statement for the entire class, including spacetimes that do not ever look like the sitter space. So let me call that the causal point of view, and that's really one of the themes here, is the question whether we should look at the sitter space and these related spacetimes globally or restrict to what one observer can see. But let me start by giving you the argument for this conclusion.
When you talk about what one observer can see, do you mean a whole space like
that? Let me postpone that, because that's one of the main things I will talk about. And then please ask me again if I don't say it clearly. Let me for now stay in the global picture, which is what I've introduced so far, and derive a necessary condition from the holographic principle, derive a necessary condition for a spacetime to be de sitter both in the past and in the future. Okay, and that is the condition I want to derive. Okay, this is of some interest partly because Ed Witten has recently considered this class of spacetimes and been interested in the question of whether they have a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Since I'm going to derive this from the covariant form of the holographic principle, let me give you a lightning review of the statement. Holographic entropy bound tells you that the entropy is less than the area over 4, and what this formulation tells you is which entropy I'm talking about. Okay, and it tells you that it's the entropy on a light sheet. So the idea is you start by specifying an area. Okay, so for example, take a sphere in more or less flat space. And then you can construct a light sheet by noting that there are 4 orthogonal null directions away from that area. Namely, you can send light rays towards the future and towards the inside, but you can also send them towards the future and the outside. Okay, and you can send them towards the past, maybe not practically, but in theory, inside and outside. Okay, so there are 4 ways of generating null hypersurfaces whose boundary is this area A. Okay, and the rule is that you pick out the ones that have decreasing cross-sectional area. For example, this cone, the light ray span decreasing cross-sectional area, also for this other cone. And you throw away the ones where the area is increasing. In this flat space example, that's sort of obvious that it's the outside ones, but this rule has the advantage that it also works, for example, in collapsing regions where the inside might be the 2 future directions because everything's collapsing, and so you get smaller there. Yes?
Can you invert this criterion so that you start with the light sheet and then you find the maximum
yes,
area?
Yes, and I will. I will. As far as I understand right now, this is the more fundamental formulation. Then you can do all sorts of tricks to turn things around. For example, you can look at a light cone, find the maximal area on that light cone, and then by construction, the cross-sectional area will be decreasing in both directions away from it. There could be a maximal area because you might have a big bang in the past, and so the area start. Okay, in which case you will be able to. But I haven't completed my story. So the light sheet is characterized by this statement that the area is non-increasing, or expansion is less than 0. And the statement is that the entropy that is passing through any such light sheet, for example through this cone, is less than the area that you started from divided by 4 in Planck units.
So here's a question.
Yes.
Well, what do you mean by this? How do you define this entropy? The point of view you take is that everything should have an operational definition. Right?
Yes.
So what is the operational definition?
Okay. That's a good question. And so one situation that you might be in, I think there are sort of 2 good situations that you might be in. One is that you have an isolated system. Okay. Something that lives in the interior of, this is the world tube of the system. Okay. In that case, I can make sense of the entropy flux through that surface. It's the same thing as the entropy flux on some spatial volume. Okay, it's just the entire entropy of that system.
You're assuming everything outside that system is vacuum in some sense.
Well, or at least that there's it's well separated from any other system, so I don't have any entanglement between
them.
Right,
okay, but it's vacuum.
Okay. Another possibility, which I think is more or less well-defined, is the situation where I am looking at a null hypersurface which crosses the entire universe, and I just find the largest area on that surface. And in that case, you know, I can bound the entropy on both sides of it. So again, it refers to, you know, it's by definition a complete physical system. Okay.
So in that case, what measurements do you make?
We're getting into deep others. I mean,
that's the whole spirit of the whole holographic business. Right?
Well, I can't answer the question, what are the observables in cosmology, if that's what you're asking. I do not know. I mean, I the idea here is that in the flat space case, the holographic principle tells us something about the number of states that I need to describe a certain system. I can at least make pretty good approximate sense of you know, the regions that I should consider in a cosmological case. So even though I don't understand quantum mechanics and cosmology completely, I can still hope that this statement will tell me something about the number of states or the number of degrees of freedom or complexity involved in describing a universe like that. But if you ask me what do I measure, I have absolutely no idea.
Why is that? I mean, this would be counting the number of states inside the observer horizon, right? That's what
right. Well, actually, yeah, let me give you a less pessimistic statement. I mean, part of what I'm going to come to in this talk is to argue that what can be observed, and maybe that's what you were getting to, is in fact contained in spatial regions which happen to be bounded precisely by such null hypersurfaces. Namely, you know, you cannot see anything, for example, that's outside your past light cone. Okay, so if you're willing to think of an experiment or an observation as simply the interior of such a region, then it is fortunate that the holographic principle tells you precisely about the entropy that you know passes through the top of this region, which means you know is on any, it's a bound on the entropy on any spatial surface that you can draw in here. Okay, so I'm sort of getting ahead of myself because this is a point that I was going to discuss in this talk. But
well, can I ask a remedial question?
Yes.
I mean, in ordinary statistical mechanics, there's an energy. You think about the entropy as a number of states on the system adding an energy.
Yes.
And so you have the first law of thermodynamics, which is, you know, change in energy is TdS minus
Kd
or whatever. So here you don't have the energy part.
Right.
So when you say number of states, you just mean all states?
Right. So for example, it's true that I do not have a general notion of energy in cosmology, but I can ask both in asymptotic and flat space and in cosmology how many states are there within a specified surface area. Right. So the number of states will be dominated by the largest black hole I can put into that surface area. But
In the black hole case, it had the mass.
Right. In the black hole case, it had the mass, which played
the role of energy.
Right.
So I understood how all the thermodynamics.
Yeah. I realize that we have to give up energy in general, and we cannot use that to hold that fixed and specify and then calculate the number of states. But that specifying a surface area and asking how many states can you have inside that surface area is the best thing, or the closest thing I can think of to specifying the energy, because in flat space it gives you almost the same answer. The number of states is dominated anyway by the largest black hole. Okay, but you can still use it in arbitrary spacetimes. Andy?
Yeah, in both of our attempts to compute Kisser entropy, we used exactly this kind of idea. And I think though both of them had shortcomings, I think they both provide models of how Eva's question might be answered of what you were calculating. So first of all, it's important that this space like flux here is not all of De Sitter's space. Right? It's just half of De Sitter's space.
And therefore, the statement that it has zero energy, is that that's a statement about all of De Sitter space. Okay, so half of De Sitter space could have some energy. Mm-hmm. And in our, to make a long story short, in our first calculation of De Sitter entropy, we were roughly counting all the states that obey asymptotically De Sitter boundary conditions at this point. And in the second one, we had the De Sitter vacuum over the entire S3, and that meant that this piece of S3 was not, this disk, which is just a piece of S3, was not in a pure state, because it was entangled with the rest of the Sitter space.
Mm-hmm.
And so there could be some states there. So what, I guess the main point is once you put a boundary in, you're no, which I believe is the right way to think about it.
Yes.
You're not, first of all, you're not constrained by the zero energy business, and you're not constrained by things being a representation of the Sitter group, because this boundary is breaking the Sitter group.
So the idea that you might have like a microcanonical calculation of entropy with a fixed energy measured on that boundary space.
That's exactly what we did in the first paper.
And is the way that you define energy on that boundary, does that, if for example, if I put a black hole into De Sitter space, does that give you something like the gravitational radius of that black, I mean the radius of that black hole? how do you define energy in for half of De Sitter space?
We had, the boundary had to be a sphere of some fixed size, and it had to be a horizon, which meant some normal. That point is on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that some kind of normal derivative had to vanish.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have some ensemble of states that satisfy that condition.
Mm-hmm. But, how do you interpret that as an energy?
It wasn't an energy.
Okay. It's a boundary condition that you're...
It's a boundary
okay.
condition.
Good. We have a dilemma here between having a nice discussion and ever completing this talk. There's no time limit. Okay, good. Okay. Yeah, great. I certainly prefer that. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to. How is this boundary condition exposed? So this.
That's great.
This was in the first paper that I wrote with Juan, and we were following some work of Carlett, who had used a similar method for counting black hole entropy. And basically, the boundary condition is that the boundary be a sphere of the De Sitter radius, and that it be a horizon, that something is null there. If you look at the change in the size of the sphere along the forward-directed time-like Schilling vector, that's null. And these boundary conditions have been discussed in relativists, and there are a lot of problems with Carlip's work. And all the problems that he had were transplanted into, what we did. But and so I don't, I think it's exactly right, or the answer to the problem of understanding De Sitter entropy. But nevertheless, I think it is a very interesting model how things might go in a better framework.
Where's the parameter that corresponds to energy?
It's basically the cosmological constant. In some sense, what the description looks like, the ground state of the system has a metric which is zero. The dynamical variable is the metric. The ground state of the system has a metric which is zero. And you count all the ways of sort of expanding out this disk by exciting the metric in such a way that you get this piece of De Sitter space.
Mm-hmm.
And you use a sort of Cardi-like formula for the count, this counting of the... And that works out exactly right with the one quarter, and Karloff also got it to work with the one quarter in the black hole case, but it's all kind of fishy because, you know, it involves this this formulation of 3D gravity is SL2C WZW model, and it's not unitary, and you're never too sure what states you're counting and so on. So I think it all got.
I'm very confused about. So, if I think of energy as a function of how much I actually have in the de Sitter space, which is maybe not how you're thinking of it, then, you know, if I put a black hole into de Sitter space, what happens is the cosmological horizon gets smaller. In fact, it loses more area than I've inserted in terms of the black hole, which is good because otherwise I could violate the second law. In that case, I cannot understand this kind of behavior if I am fixing the size of the horizon.
So that's like a larger cosmological constant.
We can't put a black hole on
three-dimensional. In three dimensions, I guess you can. That's right. Oh, okay, good. So you don't need to consider that at all.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm safe anyway. Yeah. It's more interesting model than
people. But you're saying you can't fix the boundary and count things you add in the middle because the things you add in the middle will change the boundary.
That's right. So that you cannot. That's right. You cannot hold the de Sitter boundary. I think this is sort of similar to the question of if I hold the area fixed. Whether I consider only the largest black hole, which will of course dominate the number of states, I would still expect empty de Sitter space to be by far the dominant contribution because all the other states are anthropically very unfavored. So for example, if I have a black hole in de Sitter space, the total entropy of that configuration is lower than that of empty de Sitter space. Just as if I put a small black hole into my big area that I've specified, that will make a contribution, but it's a very small number of states that contributes. I think one can still understand quite a lot by understanding just the horizon entropy of empty de Sitter space. But you would expect fluctuations due to the temperature that once in a while actually generates some of these other states. So you would probably not have a complete description. Okay, shall we proceed? So what I was trying to do was give you an argument why it is necessary that the entropy on some initial space-like slice is less than 3 pi over lambda if I wish to have asymptotic infinity both in the past and in the future. It's clear that in some vague sense I can't put too much stuff on the initial slice because I'll get this collapse kind of phenomenon, but this is a somewhat more precise statement. And the way that you derive this statement, and this is a sort of abridged argument, but has to do with the results by Gao and Wald in, I believe, 99, which is on GRQC. And this is really a consequence of some corollary that they state, and I'm not going to state the corollary, I'll just state what it means for our purposes. I told you that the de Sitter Penrose diagram is exactly a square. Okay, but you can ask what happens if I put any small perturbation, any kind of matter into that diagram, which in their language means that the null generic condition is satisfied, that every light ray meets at least one piece of matter somewhere. So effectively, how do I deform this diagram if I put some matter in? And there are really two possibilities. I can either make it like this or it can become like that. Okay. Their answer is it becomes like this. That's important because it means that the future event horizon has in its past complete Cauchy surfaces. Okay? So I can find a sufficiently early Cauchy surface such that all of its entropy later has to pass through the future event horizon. Okay? And as it also happens, the future event horizon has the wonderful property of being a light sheet. So I'm sort of doing the reverse argument now. This is a null hypersurface. And since we're ending in asymptotically de Sitter space by assumption, its area at the top will be that of the event horizon of empty de Sitter space. Okay. And so all of the entropy on the initial surface has to pass through here, so I can bound that as a quarter of this area by the covariant entropy bound. Okay. So, and I have not made any reference to observers here, and I think this is the strongest statement you can make without referring to observers. Okay, you can make a statement about this class of spacetime.
Let's see, even in the pure de Sitter space, the future horizon has a quotient surface, right? It's at the infinite past. You don't like it because
it's well, I can make the following statement. If I take, the precise statement to make is if I take the past of a point in an empty de Sitter space, there does not exist any sufficiently early Cauchy surface that is entirely contained in it. Okay. If I take the past of a sufficiently late point in a perturbed de Sitter space, there always exists a sufficiently early Cauchy surface such that it is completely contained in it. And then I'm using the fact that the future event horizon is sort of further up than the past of this point.
You can go from the case you like to this case by limiting the future.
Well, I mean, the limiting case is not very interesting because we know what the entropy is anyway. So it's, yeah.
And this essentially, physically, this is if you start out with more entropy, it collapses.
Yeah, that is physically what I would expect to happen.
You can see it.
Well, I believe that Gary and Sunny were looking at possibilities of understanding that in specific examples and seeing how much entropy you can actually, you know, how you can find examples of matter configurations that, as far as possible, saturate this. But that's a difficult problem because it's also difficult to find matter configurations that saturate, for example, the usual, you know, A over 4 bound in flat space.
What if you just, I mean, in the beginning you told us about this dust that made the thing collapse, right?
Yeah. So I don't have to exceed this bound, by the way, to make the thing collapse. I can obviously put a very massive system in there, which, this is just a necessary condition.
But if you look at this dust that you talked about at the beginning, and see what density of dust you need to,
Depends.
Right.
So
but
just give it some equation of it.
Right. Gary, I think, can comment on that.
Yeah, so I can tell you the sort of, one of the things that Sunny and I have looked at is just to take radiation.
Right.
Okay. So there you can easily see that you, if you want to have the solution not collapse, the number of states you have in the radiation allowed to is actually less than this bound.
By number or?
No, by actually a power.
Yeah.
It's a power of, well, basically, there's length scale and Planck units. Yeah, okay, so it's the area to the 3/4 power, right? Yeah.
It's a similar problem that you get by trying to maximize the area bound using a gas, a ball of gas, and just using thermodynamic calculations of the entropy. Black holes?
Well, not quite, right?
Maybe.
In de Sitter space, black holes.
No, not in de Sitter space, but in flat space. In de Sitter space?
We don't know.
I don't know. Well, in some sense, you can certainly saturate it by looking not at a matter configuration, but looking at empty de Sitter space and counting the area of the cosmological horizon there. But that's sort of cheating.
But just to make sure I understand, so if you try to make it more than the area of 3/4, you get collapses. Is that what you're saying?
If you just take simple thermal radiation and you try to increase the entropy, it doesn't matter where you start, actually. So you get this bound regardless of what time you're sort of doing the calculation. But if you try to put more entropy than that area to the 3/4, it will collapse.
Well, that's a stronger bound.
It's a stronger bound.
That's just for radiation.
Just for radiation.
And this has to do with the difficulty of finding systems, ordinary matter systems, that actually saturate holographic bounds. That's generally a very difficult thing to do. Right.
So we're not too surprised it didn't saturate it.
Because you presumably need strong gravity, I think, to saturate this bound, and it's on a microscopic scale. I don't see how it. No. You get the same problem if you try to do it in flat space.
Is it possible that if you go to the sort of stringy correspondence point, that you would saturate it with strings? or the analog of the things that you guys studied with black holes?
I think that you could. That's one of the things I'm looking at now, because you do get, I mean, the entropy proportional to the energy is what strains tend to give you. Mm. And there's a sense in which that's what you need here.
But if you just put a black hole into the De Sitter space, a problem is that the black hole area cannot be made larger than a third of A0. And so, again, by just looking at that black hole, that fills out the...
If I remember correctly, if you ask the question, how much entropy is there if I try to make a black hole by collecting radiation?
Yeah.
And I ask, then I try to count, people try to do this, right? They say, okay, let's associate the entropy of a black hole with the number of ways of forming entropy with some initial data, focusing it in, and making a black hole. And that was not parametrically less in the area. That was just a number, right?
Okay.
I think it's just a number. It wasn't a power.
I don't think it's just a number. I mean,
or if you look at the entropy produced when a black hole radiates.
Oh, then you get more.
You get more.
Number.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. By some order one number.
The entropy is increasing. So the entropy of the outgoing radiation is larger by some number.
Right, but you can basically time reverse that.
Then you're violating the second law. I mean, that's just that's one of these, you know, things where you're setting up all the air molecules in this room so that they end up in this corner for 3 seconds. And you can do that, but you don't learn anything about. But it's true that the radiation has an order one factor larger entropy than the... I think Page calculated that or something, than the black hole. All right. Good. So with space-time... Okay. If I continue to take a global point of view, which soon I will abandon, because I actually think it's not very attractive, I can easily demonstrate to you that I can exceed this bound by considering spacetimes that are De Sitter only at one end but not the other. Okay, and this is an example. Right? I can put as much entropy as I want on a large enough initial three sphere. All that happens is I get penalized by some complete collapse somewhere on the lower half of the hyperboloid. But that certainly didn't prevent me from having an initial slice with a much larger entropy.
So before we finish the global with the GS plus minus?
Yes, pretty much.
So how about addressing the issue of whether if you're in GS plus minus, you have a finite dimension?
Well, good. Right. let me comment on that. So this is an interesting result because you might ask, if I ask only for a quantum gravity theory for this class of spacetimes, it seems like I only need a finite number of states. Whether you wish to conclude from that the stronger statement that you should be looking for theories of the finite dimensional Hilbert space with a number of dimension equal to e to the 3 pi over lambda is to some extent, I think, a personal preference. But it certainly is a hint, I think, that we should take seriously and should consider looking at. And it would be very interesting to have such theories because they seem to differ significantly from most theories that we used to and know. And because a single harmonic oscillator already has an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So it's you need something very discrete.
On the other hand, if you had something for any lambda, you'd need the number of degrees of freedom to increase exponentially.
Yes.
So you need an arbitrarily large number anywhere.
Well, it is possible that there would exist a theory, a quantum gravity theory for any number of states in the Hilbert space. So there will be a whole sequence of theories with different numbers of states in the Hilbert space. It is possible also that it's only consistent to have such theories for certain numbers of states in the Hilbert space. As Witten has pointed out, he would be very surprised if one of those numbers is 10 to the 10 to the 100, which is what we would need. But,
Why would you be surprised that
if you had a whole sequence? Yeah, that's right. My comment related to the possibility that there were only a few that are somehow selected by some mathematical statement.
Why would there be only a few?
The first exception to the Riemann.
Right. No, it is. I prefer the point of view where you hope that you have a consistent theory for every value of n, for every value of the number.
What's the argument that you wouldn't expect it to be a small number?
Well, the argument is related to a hope, namely that you will be able to explain the value of the cosmological constant, and this is what I was going to get to at the end. This is the sort of lambda n correspondence that Banks is advocating, that you understand the value of the cosmological constant as the inverse of the logarithm of the dimension of the Hilbert space, and that you solve the cosmological constant problem by somehow showing that these Hilbert spaces have to have a particular number.
I'm going to specify n, and that gives me a lambda. And then I want to know why the superpartner splittings are so big.
No, that's a different problem. I mean, that's understanding the discrepancy between the supersymmetry breaking scale and the scale of the cosmological constant.
The basic cosmological constant problem.
That's one way of looking at it. But in this way of looking at it, the cosmological constant is the primary thing. And if you want to understand why it's not zero, you have to start by understanding where this big number is coming from. Okay. And then you have to worry on top of that why it is that the supersymmetry breaking scale is a comparatively large mass compared to the one that you get from the cosmological constant. But there are two separate problems. You first have to get this cosmological constant from somewhere. Okay. So
I guess the logic here is that
okay. Now, another thing I should say is that, well, this was Witten's box, okay? This was Banks's box. Well, Witten doesn't want to live in the Sitter space, but that's, it's tough. Okay. Banks was drawing this conclusion that maybe you should understand the cosmological constant in terms of the inverse of the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space on the basis of having convinced himself that the entropy in all spacetimes that are de Sitter in the future, where he was using a restriction to what an observer can see, is less than 3 pi over lambda. And my argument against, I think that's not completely convincing, because if this is true, this correspondence between lambda and n, then the Hilbert space better be good enough for describing an arbitrary lambda greater than zero universe, especially since it's hard to distinguish initial states that will lead to collapse or not to collapse anyway. They can be arbitrarily small perturbations of each other. So that's why I will aim to show that with a restriction to what an observer can see, this statement holds for all lambda greater than zero universes. So and you can see that as some positive evidence for the correspondence that Banks is suggesting. But let me get back somewhere in the direction of the track. Good. So let me just briefly give you the other argument why you can have arbitrarily large entropy if you demand only one asymptotic de Sitter infinity, but willing to look at global space-like slices. And that's, again, the universe that we live in, which looks like it's a flat FRW universe. So you have infinitely large space-like slices. There are three. You don't need S3 topology to get de Sitter in the future. It's a local phenomenon. Cosmological constant takes over, so you still have a scribe class that's de Sitter. But you can obviously put arbitrary amounts of entropy on these infinitely large slices. Okay, here's spatial infinity, which is why this is really an infinite region. So that's another example for how to violate this bound if you look at the global space-like slices. Now, before coming to the question of which parts of a universe an observer can see, I think there's a general criticism that, or at least worry that one should have about trying to define some kind of analog of scattering in the Sitter space by asking, by specifying states on the initial slice and asking what comes out on the final future infinity. So even if you restrict to these spacetimes in the Witten box, one thing that I find very unconvincing about that is that if you succeeded in describing this, you would have succeeded in describing an experiment that no one can make. Okay, and that's true in two different ways. It is not possible in a causal way to set up this initial state because it's on a space-like surface at the beginning of the space-time. And it's also not possible in any causal way to observe what comes out in the final state. But that's how you're defining your states. And that's a real problem. And to appreciate that, I think it's worthwhile contrasting that with ADS and asymptotically flat space, where the reason why we never worry about this question is that in these cases, we don't have to worry about it. It never arises, because no matter how large I make my initial slice and how widely I distribute my particles, turning off all interactions and letting them be widely separated, I can always find a future light cone of some sufficiently early point that will contain them all. So I was able to set up these four particles that I'm sending in here in a causal way. And I don't need to talk about it usually. It's understood. Okay, and then I can scatter them and they come back out. Maybe three particles come back out. And it's always possible to find a light cone of an observer, past light cone of an observer at a sufficiently late time, who can in fact see all of these three particles and say, yes, they came out. Okay. In this case, if I send in, let me make a cutoff, if I send in four particles, there's no one who could have set them up. And if three particles come out, well, there are a couple of guys who see one particle, and some people don't see any particle at all, but nobody can confirm what the state is. Yes?
What if you define it by a limiting procedure where it looks like this, in, like you do in the future, but then there's a collapsing shell of matter that comes in afterwards that sort of refocuses. Right, because you can have something that looks very much like consider space for a very long time.
Oh, that's completely different.
Well,
because I'm asking about space-times that are asymptotically de Sitter in the future, and I'm exploiting this universality and the asymptotic structure of the space-time to define my states in the first place.
Okay.
Right. So yeah. By definition, I cannot have what you were just talking about.
But it seems like you could approximate this kind of thing arbitrarily closely that way.
I,
right. You
can't
get all the way to future infinity, but you can get as close as you like.
No. In order to explore,
space you have the less likely that it will not collapse again. Like if it's going to collapse, it collapses in the middle.
Right. No, but that's the wrong way around of looking at the problem. The only way that I know to define states is by exploiting the universality of the asymptotic metric, by using the fact that states are widely separated there. That I can even, I mean, that's the whole point of, that's what we're trying to do when we define an S matrix. We want interactions turned off. If I'm not near that future infinity, I don't know how to do that.
Okay, there's no other way to get something where you can measure.
Another argument would be if you actually cut off the sitter after some long period of inflation and had just flat space or something.
Okay, yeah.
Then you wouldn't have any horizons.
Yeah.
Speaking, the horizon is the past.
So here's a de Sitter region that corresponds to inflation. If you glue onto that some closed universe that corresponds to it's a completely different story, right? Then a scattering experiment that takes place entirely within the de Sitter region will be observable afterwards. But I mean you can construct all sorts of baroque situations. But I think we should ask about the
so you can't do this at on supply plus.
So
even in flat space.
Right, but in flat space I can take a limit where you can tell me how large you want your particles to be separated before they're detected. Okay, now you've built a detector of a certain size. I don't care how large your detector is, I can always find someone who lives far enough in the future that he is able to read off all parts of that detector. Okay, that is not the case in de Sitter space.
Well, it seems like, morally speaking, you could do something like that in de Sitter space, with, say, a sandwich of de Sitter space between, flat space, two segments of flat space. Again,
I don't understand how you construct space-times like that.
Well,
What he wants to do is slow down. Turn off the cosmological constant.
Right. No. If you don't have a fixed cosmological constant, almost everything I say is not correct. Almost all that I say depends on the fact that you have a fixed cosmological constant that does not get turned off in the future. If you turn it off in the future, you can do whatever you want.
Okay.
So that's a different space-time. Just like we don't suddenly turn off the negative cosmological constant of ADS when we're talking about ADS, I want to have the rules of the game that we do not turn off the positive cosmological constant here.
No, but if you can't turn it off, then you might expect that you can study the case where there is a cosmological constant as a limiting case.
If I don't turn it off?
No, if you can turn it off.
Right.
You might think, okay, I should be able to.
No, you can hope so, but I think then you will be missing some crucial qualitative difference that you have only in asymptotically de Sitter spaces. I mean, yes, you might well be able to, study certain phenomena in space terms that locally look like de Sitter for an amount of time, but then stop to look like it. But I think a lot of the reasons that make de Sitter space interesting is precisely that it forces us to address some questions that we usually like to avoid. And so let me focus precisely. I mean, that's why I'm...
Just like a two-particle scatter.
Yeah.
That cannot be observed.
They cannot be observed.
You're saying a simple scatter, two-particle scatter. Not set up that as a limit of some finite time
experiment. So I take these two particles, I send them in, they scatter, they come back out.
Now, but if we extend the diagram,
you can't extend the diagram. Because the diagram is whatever it is. It's that's the shape of de Sitter space. There's a future singularity which is space-like. There's no way around it.
The things that it's hard probably to accept for us, right, is that if you make a model of quintessence or something that the cosmological constant is dynamical,
yes,
you can make physics for a long period of time to be identical as physics in the system. You
yes.
expect that this physics wouldn't be affected by the eventual future will happen after we turn it off, right? So you say that the physics even inside this long period of time is affected by the asymptotic future. Now, this is a proposal that Tom always emphasizes. Two universes that are apparently very close to each other really differ drastically just because they are affected by the future. Is it what you
think? I agree with what you're saying. I will put the spin the other way around and sort of say that the fact that such universes exist and may in fact describe the universe we live in should make us focus on these hard problems that they throw up. It is true that you can find universes which are very close locally to them, but which do not have the global structure that makes these problems arise.
Rafael, I just want to point out one other thing. That is that in the case of ADS,
yeah,
you can do something very much like this, because you can consider the three-brain geometry with the asymptotic region and scatter stuff off of it and get the actual scattering within the anti-de Sitter space as a limiting case of the amplitudes where you have those asymptotic regions.
Right, but presumably there you don't have a qualitative change in the causal structure that that is accompanied by a complete change of perspective as to whether you can actually observe these things or not.
There's the limit where you throw away the asymptotic flat space.
Yeah.
And then there the causal structure looks different.
Yeah.
It's ADS, not flat space.
Yeah, but Minkowski and ADS both have in and out space.
Yeah.
So yeah, in states in your Minkowski space, you would transform into some in states on the ADS.
Yeah, there you go.
You get out states in your ADS system, and then you turn those into out states of the Minkowski.
Right, right.
But here you don't have the in and out states of.
This is a way.
Okay, the good students have to be quiet now. Someone in the back.
I think that de Sitter space is very different from anti-de Sitter space. If one tries to draw the analogy, of course, for the obvious reason that de Sitter space has an entropy, an anti-de-Sitter doesn't. Mm-hmm. So while it's clear that it makes sense to think of anti-de-Sitter space as some ground state, maybe scattering around it and so on, it's not so clear that that's the right way to think about de-Sitter space. So couldn't, somebody was talking about turning off the de-Sitter cosmological concept. Couldn't you imagine if you knew the right way to do that, that you turn it off and then all the de-Sitter energy would turn into some kind of thermal stuff and then you could count that? And that could be the answer.
So you're talking about the end of inflation, right?
The end of inflation. Inflation.
Yeah.
And a bunch of thermal stuff comes out, and that was the entropy.
Flat space.
Flat space.
We wouldn't expect to go somehow from flat space.
ADS and generate a bunch of thermal
stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. Raphael, well, coming back to this causal thing, experiment you've been doing, you've done this on the Penrose diagram.
Yeah.
Everything's been rescaled. Is there actually some finite distance here that is excluded, or is it all infinite distance?
Which distance are you asking about?
Scattering event, right?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly.
So these two points. If you're asking, are these two particles at a finite distance from each other? The answer is yes. They're at a finite distance from each other.
I can't see.
But nevertheless, you couldn't have set them up. And similarly, the ones here are at a finite distance from each other, but nevertheless, you cannot detect them.
There's no way you can send because, a signal from one detection.
Right. This particle is outside your horizon.
Or to anyone else.
Okay. Now. Good. So, one point I was trying to make is that in cosmology, I think we should address precisely this question. That's why I'm dwelling on it. You can't avoid it. We usually can avoid it because implicitly it's clear that it doesn't arise in ADS and Minkowski usually. But there is another reason why we should think of this. This is so far mostly an aesthetic argument. Okay, you might still hope that you can define some kind of formal theory in terms of the scattering, and then maybe there'll be some complicated translation of that into what an observer actually sees. Okay, maybe you can do that. But there's at least one example we know of in quantum gravity where it's been argued that to look at global Cauchy surfaces can lead to actual paradoxes, and it is simply wrong to do so, and you should only ask about questions that can be answered by one observer at a time. And that is the example that Lenny gave us of black hole complementarity, where I can set up a situation where I have a space-like slice such that on that same space-like slice, I see both the system that fell in, so I see one copy of the information, but also the radiation that is coming out and telling the observer that scattering is in fact unitary, the observer on the outside. Okay. So it looks like I have quantum Xerox, the quantum state of the system, and made two copies out of one. And that can't happen. There's a no-go theorem that tells you that can't happen. So I've constructed a paradox. And at least in this case, I have a strong argument that I, in fact, have to restrict to what any one observer can see. Because there is no paradox. As soon as I do that, there's no one observer who can see both copies of this information. The outside guy sees this, the inside guy sees that. Okay, so I think that should also motivate us to make a restriction like that. And what I want to do in the remainder of this talk is to give you an argument of what I think this restriction should be in general. And then to apply this general prescription to de Sitter space and to the asymptotically de Sitter or lambda greater than zero space times.
This restriction on doing quantum field theory.
I don't know whether it makes sense to do quantum field theory at a fundamental level. In a fixed background. No, I'm not even referring to a background in what I'm going to say. Let me tell you what I'm about to say, and then because it's sort of. Okay, so what I want to argue is that a fundamental theory should give you, should be able to describe any experiment that one can make, but not more than that. Okay, and by an experiment, I mean something, you can criticize that, but I think that's a good first approximation, something that I start at some point on a world line and end at some point on a world line. You can later, as a special case, take these points to be as far apart from each other as you want in order to make the experiments large and the regions probed very large. But I can make the discussion in general, and that will just be a special case. Okay. So I'm starting the experiment at point P and I'm ending it at point Q. And I'm asking which information in the space-time can actually play a role in this information, in this experiment. In other words, in some sense, how many states, how many possible outcomes are there to this experiment? Okay. So certainly, I think you will agree with me that it's unlikely that anything that's outside the past light cone of Q will play a role in this experiment. So let me exclude that and look only at the causal past of Q. Okay. But I would also argue that you should furthermore exclude also what is outside the future light cone of P. So I want to intersect that with the causal future of P and consider only this region. And the reason why I want to do that is that if I want to learn something about information that is here, you might think that I can see it, but it's not enough for it to be in my past light cone because I can't send a probe here and look at it. Okay? I can only detect it if it enters a place that I can probe, which I can consider all of this my apparatus, if you will, but I can't make it any larger than that. Okay? So I want to consider, for the purposes of calculating the maximal entropy involved in an experiment, I want to consider only space-time regions of this form.
But you will detect it. I can see it physically, and I can see that. But
yeah, so but then the amount of information that you learn about this system is given by how many photons scatter off it and enter here. And that's really what I'm asking about. Okay. So I'm not saying that it's meaningless to say that there's a, you know, cosmic microwave background, but I'm saying that you're not going to learn any more about it than what fits in here. If all these photons were focused in right at us, you would have formed a black hole.
Okay, so conversely, you're saying if it's in that wedge, I can sort of completely characterize its, all of the internal states of it, or whatever.
Throw something at it and see what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I can see that. I will try to skip the question of, you know, division between system and apparatus and so on, and I will just basically consider all of this as the observer, the experiment together.
Experiment P prepares something, Q observes.
Well, where P you can you can think of this as your maximally fast setting up of an initial state. So you start that process at P. And but they're not at points. But if I want to set them up in a causal way, I have to start the setup at a point, or I have to connect this. So of course, in practice, my experiment really is this. You know, it's some tiny apparatus in the middle of here. Here I decided I'm going to build LEP. Or
that's when you were born, and that's when you died.
All right.
Okay. Most of us have two parents, right? It's just not one P, but 2 points P1 and P2.
That's known as a scattering experiment. Okay. Yeah. I think you're not treating my proposal with the seriousness it deserves. Good.
Here you're talking about experiments where you ask a question and then you find out the answer. There are lots of experiments where you can find out the answer without ever asking the question. I mean, I can ask how many, G-type stars there are compared to A-type stars.
But if you answered this question, if you decide here to ask this question, how many G-type stars are there, and to start looking for them and end it at Q, the amount of information, the number of bits that you're going to get is bounded in terms of how much fits in this region. Because whatever you're going to learn about these stars...
I don't have to send anything to the star. It's sending me tons of stuff.
That's right. But all of this stuff that it's sending you has to be observed by some of your apparatuses.
So it has to be in the past cone. Well,
no, it has to also be in the future of P. It has to be...
Including the photons from that object.
What if my grandfather decided to ask this question and left me all this information? I don't understand.
This information would still enter into that future light cone. Otherwise, you can't read it off. If your grandfather leaves you a will that's lying around here, it doesn't buy you anything. You have to hope that the will travels in here. Okay. Or that it emits photons that go in here. That's right. I don't think there's a way around that. If you, on the other hand, had yourself decided, you know, to start fishing around in your grandfather's document, then, you know, at an earlier time, then you could have detected that will and made sure that it, you know, doesn't get lost, or you have to later hope for photons.
It's terribly subjective. I just have to look for G-type stars.
You look through your telescope, but all that you're going to see are photons that have entered that apparatus. And these photons, here you decided to look into your telescope. This is your telescope. It's in fact much smaller than this thing. There's some thin roll tube here. All that you're going to see are photons that have...
Okay, so the information has moved into that zone. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But it started out somewhere else.
That's fine. I'm not agreeing that it's, I'm not saying that it's meaningless to talk about, you know, the G-type stars that live here, but I'm asking how much information can I gain by an experiment that starts at P and ends at Q?
But you could have said that the photon is inside, right?
Hmm? Well, if the photon didn't enter here, I'm not going to see it, so I'm not going to learn about that aspect of the...
Is it invariant?
For some reason, this always generates a discussion. Good. The funny thing is that, in fact, for most of what I'm going to say, you don't, in fact, need this restriction. But there are certain universes which start out De Sitter and end in a big crunch, where you would not be able to get the conclusion that the entropy is less than 3 pi over lambda if you did not have this additional restriction. But For our universe, if it really did have a big bang in the past, it doesn't actually matter very much. I mean, it might give you a factor of 2 somewhere, but it doesn't. It doesn't allow you to put infinite amounts of entropy. You cannot put infinite amounts of entropy in the past light cone of a point if that past light cone ends on a big bang and the future is considered. I believe you might, but I'd have to go back and look at the details. That's somewhat technical. And so if you're interested, for example, in a state that you specify on a space-like slice, and again, I mean, what I'm saying here is completely independent of De Sitter space, okay, or De Sitter spacetimes. I think it should be a general principle applied to cosmological spacetimes. Then I would expect a fundamental theory to make statements about this state only if it fits within a region of this form, if it fits within one of these causal diamonds. Okay. If there does not exist a causal diamond that fits around it, then I think you're making the black hole complementarity mistake. You're looking at things that cannot be seen. And I want to point out again that in asymptotically flat space and an anti-De Sitter space, modulo black holes, you can always find causal diamonds, around any arbitrarily large spatial surface. So you don't right in Minkowski space, sort of the whole space is just one big causal diamond. Yeah, that's right. And the Sitter space is well a quarter actually. So this is what I'm going to come to now, which is finally the.
Oh,
yeah, it does. And ADS, it's even nicer because ADS just keeps going. So, you know, that's a causal diamond. It doesn't have to have an edge. The two cones don't actually have to intersect necessarily. That's the actual specification in it.
If
what's commenting though is that these causal diamonds are not invariant under the De Sitter group.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah.
So once you set up things this way, there's no reason to think that states you're counting, whatever they may be, should be necessarily be invariant under the De Sitter group.
Yeah, didn't Witten have independent arguments for that?
We didn't do this.
Right, but I mean, he argued that the De Sitter group doesn't actually act in De Sitter space, and so.
No. But, well, he said that they all had to be annihilated by the De Sitter group.
Yeah.
So they had to be in the trivial representation of the De Sitter
group. Oh, I see.
Which is a very strong constraint, and that led him to that leads to these conclusions, I think, about the finite dimensional.
But
here, the De Sitter group wouldn't give you such powerful constraint.
Okay.
Well, what does the De Sitter group do to one of these diamonds? Can't destroy it.
It just moves it to another diamond.
It moves it to a different diamond. It doesn't leave it at the same place. It just. You can think of that. Banks would probably argue that it just corresponds to a gauge transformation in some sense, that you're moving to a different part.
Can you ask what subgroup of
it's
the
like, look,
keep
it's
you in
like,
that diamond?
It's like the statement that in general relativity, you know, closed universe, everything has to be annihilated by the Hamiltonian. If you have an open universe, you have a boundary in there, and the Hamiltonian acts on it and changes the new things, but there's a lot. You know, now that the state's going to have energy and so on. And so once you've got this boundary and the boundary is moved around by the circle, I think it's a different story. It's that they don't have to be annihilated by the circle.
So there'll be more states.
Okay.
So are you concluding from this that you should see less states of the putative entropy of your diamond was small?
No.
What was the conclusion?
No. Can I first apply this diamond to De Sitter space and then we discuss that? Okay. So I basically want to go to square one again now and start over with De Sitter space. And discuss it now from the point of view of this of a local observer who can only see what is in these causal diamonds. And see what kind of picture we get from that perspective.
Professor, might be something wrong with this picture quantum mechanically, because in observing the photon, in saying that the photon should have inside this diamond, you assume that the photon existed before you observed it.
Yes, I do. I'm not able to understand, you know, quantum mechanics questions at that level from these approximations. I mean, I. No, but I mean.
Suppose you have a plane wave.
Right.
You think of what.
But I'm hoping that whatever observation I make, I mean, whatever observation I do actually make, will correspond to some state of the whole system.
Yes.
Okay. And I want to restrict that entropy in terms of the sizes of the of these causal diamonds. Let me sort of give you the inside scoop on De Sitter now. What does it look like? Not from this global point of view where you pretend you're God and you're looking at the whole hyperboloid, but you're looking only at a portion of De Sitter space that has this property that it is a causal diamond. And we might as well just look at the largest causal diamond that you can put into De Sitter space. Okay, let me draw again the causal diagram. So let me put my point P as early as possible, my point Q as late as possible, in which case the causal diamond will be this sort of left triangle in empty De Sitter space. And this just so happens to be the region of the spacetime that is covered by another very popular coordinate system, the static coordinate system. Okay, where V of R is, and this looks a bit like Schwarzschild, except that V of R is not 1 minus 2m over R, but 1 minus R squared over R0 squared. Okay, which tells you that from this guy's perspective, there is a horizon R equals R0. Okay. So let's describe what the space looks like from someone who's living here. If you have an object that you're holding at a fixed distance, r equals constant, then that is the orbit of that object, okay? And it'll feel like it's tugging on you. It's pulling away. It's sort of attracted to this cosmological horizon, okay? It's also redshifted, and it's redshifted more and more the further away it is, okay? And if you let your object go too far, you're never going to get it back, okay? So from an observer's point of view, living in the sitter space is like being surrounded by a black hole. You live in a kind of cavity. If you let things go, they fall into the wall of the cavity, and it looks like they get thermalized or something. I should say that this black hole analogy has been argued to carry over to the semi-classical level, that in fact, you should associate an entropy with the wall of that cavity, with the horizon, equal to its area, and the area is, once again, is A0. So the entropy would be that divided by 4. Okay. Now, why would you want to make an argument like that? Let's recall briefly why Bekenstein-Hawking entropy was introduced for black holes. And the motivation would be that you can have a black hole and a matter system with some matter entropy. You can throw the matter system into the black hole and apparently destroy the matter entropy and violate the second law. But fortunately, the black hole area increases in this process. And so if you assign an entropy also to the area, the second law is rescued. There's at least a chance that it is. But you might say, well, in the sitter space, why would I want to do that? Because I'm talking about an empty space-time, so I don't have anything to throw into that cosmological horizon anyway. So why, you know, go through the exercise? But that's because, in that case, you were looking at it the wrong way. You should think of this as the final state. And this is what I said earlier. If you ever had a system to throw into the cosmological horizon in the first place, then in the beginning, your cosmological horizon was less than A0. Okay, and you can explicitly verify that for example, black holes in the sitter space. And so you can still go through the second law exercise and check that if you throw the black hole across the horizon, or you just move relative to the black hole, which looks the same, that you have a process in which the total entropy, the total area, actually increases. That's why it still makes sense to assign that entropy. One thing that confuses me, and that perhaps we can discuss another time, is the fact that it seems like you cannot completely exchange matter and horizon entropy as much as you want. In other words, a black hole I can wait until it completely evaporates, and I have all the entropy in matter. But the smallest I can make this horizon is one-third of its original size, as long as I insist on having an asymptotic de Sitter infinity. So if you cannot make a black hole, so when you increase the size of the black hole, think of a sequence of solutions, you increase the size of the black hole, the cosmological horizon gets smaller and smaller, but it meets, you know, the two are equal size when the black hole is one-third of the original size. This is a different number in other dimensions, but it goes, I mean, it's something like 1 over e if d goes to infinity, but it's...
So how does the diagram look?
And
that wedge kind of moves out when the black hole hits it or something?
So if I, to draw a Schwarzschild de Sitter diagram, it looks like that, if I fully extended. And I can identify across here. So the space-like sections are S1 cross S2. So these spheres here correspond to the black hole horizon. And these, cosmological horizon, these correspond to the black hole horizon. And in the limit where I make the black hole maximally large, every point in this diagram has the same size 2-sphere.
Okay. And when the black hole shrank?
Well, I can draw for you, it's easier if I actually draw for you the process that corresponds to just an ordinary system, because I don't want to draw these black hole singularities as well. Let me see if this answers your question. So if I have a de Sitter space with actually some matter in it, okay, then I can think of it in the following way. There's a matter system which enters here. It's a star. Now, what I'm drawing here is an apparent horizon. The actual event horizons are, of course, these things. Okay. But what this means is that the place where the expansion of light rays becomes zero, and you know, where locally nothing can enter into my region, moves in, moves closer to me. In other words, an experiment that I start after the star has moved into my domain will not see a horizon area larger than this smaller AC, which is less than A0. Okay. It's only experiments that start and end before the star moves in. This is an infinite amount of time, so I can do plenty of those, which see the full De Sitter horizon. But while I have the star there, I will see a smaller horizon. And then when I throw the star across, this is, by the way, a good way of seeing why the diagram gets higher than wide if you put some matter into the De Sitter space. I mean, that's sort of, you might have guessed that intuitively by drawing things like that.
So it's not, I'm not sure. It sounds, I'm not sure how to reconcile the case. Isn't it the case if you're an observer in the De Sitter space and you throw a mass?
Anti?
A De Sitter space, and you throw a mass across the horizon. The horizon grows.
If you throw it out.
Yeah, if you throw it out, the horizon grows.
And that is enough to compensate.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. That's what I was arguing just before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can't, he's just saying you can't turn all the horizon into a black hole.
That's right. It's not like in the case of a black hole where I can wait for the black hole to evaporate and hope that all of the information is going to come back out in terms of, you know, radiation that I can somehow measure. In the case of De Sitter, first of all, the most anthropically favored configuration is that where everything is in the horizon. And secondly, even if I was hoping for an event where that horizon would shrink, as long as I want to keep the asymptotic De Sitter property, the largest it can shrink corresponds to a process where a maximal size black hole comes in. And even then, there is still a De Sitter horizon of one-third the original area.
Okay. There's some kind of exiting from inflation that can happen.
Well, but again, that sort of violates the ground rules of what I'm trying to do. But this is true, and it might be very interesting to study such models. I mean, it's that's absolutely right. Okay. So what I wanted to say is that from this point of view, I mean, what I've really moved implicitly is sort of from a pure De Sitter space to one that is just as De Sitter in the past and the future in discussing this, if I'm talking about things that are moving in and going out. But one point I'm trying to make is that you can basically verify that the total matter entropy plus the horizon entropy will not exceed 3 pi over lambda for any of these configurations. Okay. And that is sort of the corresponding statement to the result for this Witten box, in which case I wasn't considering horizon entropy, but instead I was considering states that are defined on global slices, which sort of compensates for that, and I can again write down this bound. Okay. But now I want to just give you an abbreviated argument why these causal diamonds rescue you even in situations where on global slices you could have arbitrary entropy for spacetimes that are De Sitter only on one end. So let me draw one such spacetime. Suppose you start with a big bang and let this be a flat FRW universe. So these are infinitely large slices. Here's R equals zero and here's the De Sitter infinity. Okay. So on this global Cauchy surface, I could have arbitrary entropy. But in fact, it's enough to consider just this restriction. If I look at the past light cone of some point Q, I see that because basically a De Sitter horizon forms and cloaks my view, prevents me from ever seeing all of this slice, I only ever see a part of it. Okay, to show that that's a, you know, satisfies this bound is a different matter, but that just should convince you that there's something new going on. If there was no cosmological constant, that would be the diagram for a flat FRW universe, and if I waited long enough, I could see arbitrarily large portions. Okay, so this is what the cosmological constant does. It cuts it off here for you. And then, you know, similar arguments can be made for collapsing universes. Again, you know, the causal diamond just picks out a part of a space-like slice, and you can't see anything more than that. And finally, you know, a similar argument can be made for spacetimes which are not asymptotically de Sitter anywhere. And the way that you make the argument in general and actually show that the maximum entropy contained in a causal diamond is 3 pi over lambda works roughly as follows. Basically, what you need to show is that, so let me draw one such diamond again. Okay. That since, you know, the entropy on any space-like slice that I can draw through the diamond sooner or later has to pass through this top cone. It is enough for me to bound the entropy on the top cone, which fortunately is a null hypersurface. So all I need to do is look for the largest area on the top cone, which the largest spatial area, you know, the spatial areas start growing. They might start decreasing before I get to the edge, or they, you know, the maximal area may also be on the edge. It doesn't matter. What you can show is that if you're in a spacetime with positive cosmological constant, this maximal area is less than A0, the horizon area of empty de Sitter space. And so you can then apply the covariant entropy bound to both sides of that maximal area, thus covering the entire top cone with light sheets, with two light sheets. This is a handwriting argument because actually what I would be getting is a factor of two larger bound. Okay. So you need some more subtle arguments to show that in fact on one side you can put a much stronger bound than on the other and get to this. But that gives you the flavor of the argument that, you know, because of this property you have a certain geometric property in the spacetime that the maximal area on the top cone of a causal diamond cannot be larger than A0.
This is
and,
this
yes.
actually your general, more general result. Like here you're just talking about the 80 diamonds in consider, but you could have, say, dust or something.
So I'm talking about any spacetime with, you know, so we start by specifying a positive value of lambda, but then this result holds for, you know, no matter what the other matter content of that spacetime is, what the global structure of that spacetime is, I'm not using any of that other than the fact that you better not have, you know, highly unphysical things like negative energy.
That looks like lambda, then that would
but you're not, lambda. You're not, you must have some assumption.
Sorry, on?
On
P. Right, I was just saying that. You have an assumption on the physicality of energy, which in my case is the null energy condition, which is, you know, weaker than any of the ones that are often considered to be reasonable on a large scale, like the dominant energy condition and strong and weak ones. Which basically tells you that light rays are always focused by matter. And so it's a reasonable energy condition. But that's really all you, that and that you have lambda greater than zero is all you need. So that's why that covers the entire big box here. Okay? That you can have a space time that's completely dominated by dust, for example, at all times, and it will still apply to it. And intuitively, you can sort of understand that because the characteristic surfaces in that spacetime have to remain fairly small in order for it never to be dominated by the cosmological constant. Okay, I mean, I'm not sure if that helps, but it's
well,
not quite such a miracle.
Give you the best bound, give you some bound.
So I mean, there are many solutions, obviously, in which you cannot even come close to saturating that bound. If you have a tiny closed universe that expands and recollapses immediately, and you know, the cosmological constant is many orders of magnitude, different scale, then you're not going to come close to saturating it. But what this result does support is what I'd like to call the lambda n correspondence, the association, you know, of a one-to-one correspondence between a positive cosmological constant lambda and the number of states that you need in a Hilbert space to describe, you know, all the experiments that can be made in such spacetimes. So this is an idea that Banks had. Well, there's sort of levels of extremeness of this idea. What I've just said is a suggestion that you might want to associate a Hilbert space of this size to a quantum gravity theory that describes spacetimes with this value of the cosmological constant. That's not yet the most extreme statement. But it's certainly a much stronger statement than the entropy bound that I've shown, which I think is just a result that I think, you know, I'm fairly convinced by. But this is a stronger statement. And there are, you know, you can think of many ways in which you might avoid that, because you can just somehow develop a sector of a theory with an infinite number of states, which you then use to describe these spacetimes.
Actually, your statement that, you know, you can't actually extract all entropy from the horizon in the interspace and put it to matter suggests it's actually the wrong thing.
Well, this is a statement which I've always qualified by saying that that's as long as you demand that you have an asymptotic infinity in the past and future. If I start, for example, with a spacetime that starts with a Big Bang, and I just don't have a horizon at all in the beginning, then I can envisage a situation where I have all, you know, entropy and matter in the beginning, and then as the horizon develops, it all falls, in a sense, through the cosmological horizon and leaves its imprint there, and the entropy gets stored there. So that's a...
The transcendental number? Non-integer?
Well, in fact, Ed was making a pretty big deal, as far as I know, of the fact that this would suggest that lambda has to be quantized for there to be a consistent quantum theory of gravity of it. Of course, it's quantized incredibly small steps. And I've had discussions with Lubash, and you know, you can have similar arguments that would tell you that the mass of a black hole is quantized. If you believe that a black hole is described by a Hilbert space that is e to the, you know, has dimension e to the area. And the reason why we don't really believe in that is that the width of the black hole is much larger than, so in other words, the black hole decays in a finite time. And the time you would need to observe the mass to sufficient accuracy by the uncertainty principle to detect the spacing is exponentially larger than the decay time of the black hole. And you can make...
You could put a black hole on a box, in a microcanonical ensemble on a box, and then you would expect...
Well, I suspect that the discrepancy is so large that I would probably guess if I thought about it long enough, I can still come up with an argument why you can't see it. For example, the fact that there is radiation in there at all should already disturb the system sufficiently. And this would be an argument for why you can't observe the cosmological constants with sufficient accuracy to see which value of n corresponds to.
If you have a finite system below any energy, there should be a finite number of states, right?
Yeah.
So the energy levels have to be discrete.
Oh, that's right. You still can ask whether there's any way to actually see the discreteness in the sense of observing the energy accurately enough. And for example, in the case of the cosmological constant, you would expect that the horizon fluctuates enough that, you know, basically fluctuates by at least one Planck area. You can't see its area any better than that. And that already corresponds to a factor of e squared in the dimension of the Hilbert space. So, you know, plus minus one Planck area. So it's hard to see how this would make any sense in an operational way.
So if you're traveling through the sitter space with a cup of coffee. And you include your back reaction and so on. Is that, I guess this is related to your earlier discussion. Does that mean that the de Sitter horizon has to be smaller?
Yes. It does.
And people have checked whether that obeys
yes.
bound.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, what I did is you can check straightforwardly for black holes, small Schwarzschild black hole. In the de Sitter space, you just look at the Schwarzschild de Sitter solution and read off the areas, okay, and you find that the total area of black hole plus cosmological horizon is in fact less than a zero. So in particular, the area of the cosmological horizon has decreased by more than to, you know, compensate for the black hole that you've put. And you can ask a more general question, which is, you know, a black hole, you would not, in fact, expect to somehow maximize the amount of entropy that you can put into a de Sitter space of a given area of the cosmological horizon, because you can generate more entropy by smearing out the mass that you have into longer modes. Okay, so if you then turn the argument around and ask, how much entropy can I have in a De Sitter space with, you know, with cosmological horizon area delta A smaller than A0? So some, you know, it turns out that the maximal entropy that you can have works out to be pi times the gravitational radius times the cosmological horizon radius. Gravitational radius of the system, I mean the radius of an equivalent black hole, but black hole that would have the same size cosmological horizon associated to it, which is an interesting constraint because it takes exactly the same form as the Bekenstein bound in flat space, which is pi times gravitational radius times size of the system. Okay. Usually you write gravitational radius as 2m, but that's a perfectly nice way of stating it. And so by sort of making an analogous argument to the one that Bekenstein was making, saying, you know, when you throw a system into a black hole, you sort of calculate the minimum amount that the area increases in the black hole, and the entropy of the system better have been less than that. You get this bound. Okay. You can make an analogous argument in De Sitter space, and you get a very similar bound.
So, but in the case of the black hole, the area of the black hole is supposed to be the entropy of the black hole. It's not supposed to be the entropy of the black hole plus whatever you might throw in or plus the stuff.
Yeah, same here. So I'm
well,
considering.
So you just answered my question the other way.
No, wait.
Two questions. I don't know the answer. Just throwing this out. So is this De Sitter entropy in some sense, which I won't be able to be precise enough, the entropy of ground state of De Sitter space, or is it the entropy of all possible things that might be in De Sitter space?
Oh,
and your answer to my previous question suggested the latter.
Oh, I see.
No, because putting something in doesn't increase.
That decreases pressure.
Actually, it decreases. Yeah.
Fix some boundary, but then let expectations happen.
Well,
I would, yeah.
We were in a theory with no extra stuff in it.
I would think about it differently, Annie, in the sense that I would expect there to be all these different configurations of matter and horizons and various causal diamonds. Okay, and the ones that correspond by far to the overwhelming number of states are the ones where you only have the cosmological horizon of De Sitter space and no matter. Okay, because you always have to exponentiate this entropy, and so all the states that I can describe by having a smaller cosmological horizon and some matter in it give a negligible contribution to the total number of states. So I'm not sure that the question is, you know, well defined in the sense that whether I say that the total number of states is e to the 3 pi over lambda or that plus epsilon is something I can't really distinguish well.
But you're saying most of these states would just look. But there's a big difference.
No, I think that this I think one could take this to be the entropy of everything which has asymptotically De Sitter boundary conditions. So, say in the past and future, to keep things simple. And one way to think about it is
likely state is one which is doesn't matter.
Well, no. Yeah. What I'm going to say is that you often wait for the black hole to settle down before trying to understand its entropy. I mean, we should be able to do the dynamical thing, but we can't. So we wait for it to settle down. Waiting for the sitter to settle down is like going to the distant future, where the horizon always increases to its pure De Sitter value.
And all matter is escaped.
And all matter has sort of already crossed the horizon. So that's the analog of sort of having the black hole settle down, and you're always sort of ending up with just the.
I would suggest that the current interpretation, which is a little bit probably wrong, you know, in the analogy of the sitter space and the black hole, the sitter space is a black hole outside us, right? The only difference between the sitter and black hole is that the horizon is outside, and if you want to throw something to the sitter, throwing something to the black hole, which is not compound, which is all the rest of the universe. So can we interpret the entropy as the logarithm of the states that can happen behind the horizon? So that this inside our horizon volume is like outside the black hole, it's vacuum. Right. But what is outside is
I don't think I can comment in a very precise way, but my interpretation of these sort of statements is that they help us translate between the local and the global point of view, but that they're not in themselves very deep statements, because ultimately we should not think of the outside. It's not a meaningful part of the space-time to anybody.
But it's probably like the black hole.
Black hole. Certainly perfectly consistent with the phrase.
No, all of our observations were made outside.
Yeah. I'm not sure what that means, because we can't see anything that's behind the horizon. All that we know is that it represents the number of different states for the radiation that's eventually going to come out.
It'd be a question of how many microscopic waves you can make this space, or at least this rift of this space.
Well, that okay.
From that point of view, it sounds like you'd start with zero. Radius, right?
Well,
and then throw things in.
Mm-hmm. Say that again? So you want to start with a big bang where you don't have a horizon and the horizon starts building up?
If you start with the center space and then add matter and throw it past the horizon.
Right, but if you assume that the space is asymptotically desiderate at both ends, you can't start with zero cosmological horizon. But you can do something like that if you assume that you start with a Big Bang. I would prefer to take a point of view which is perhaps a bit more radical than what you were suggesting, which is to think that every possible causal diamond that I can draw in a lambda greater than zero space-time corresponds to one of these states. And the overwhelming number of states I get from causal diamonds that I draw in empty de Sitter space. But there are all these far less entropic states which correspond to some black hole in the
space.
So there's
actually, are you familiar with this, the quasi-local quantum field theory work that was done? There's a whole theory,
no.
By the way. Theory of quantum field theory in curved space times, where you start by looking at precisely these causal diamonds. You look at field operators, where they have, based on test functions with support inside there, you get some C-star algebra, and then you can construct states from that C-star algebra. So it's an algebraic quantum field theory approach, which sort of heavily uses these sort of causal diamonds.
Right. Has this been done in flat space?
No, it was done in curved space. The whole point was to do it for curved space times. And I mean, it was all worked out, let's say late 70s or 80s.
Who are the major providers?
Well, I'm an astronaut, I guess.
But there's been this recent stuff by Marco Polo. Very horrible.
So that's
sort of worried a lot about noise.
And what is this? And what is so and?
I think it was sort of just trying to sort of make, some more precise statements about quantum field theory and these interesting, curved space.
Okay. So, just because this has been a wonderful discussion and sort of you probably the individual points of that I was trying to say were a bit diluted, let me bring them together. Tell you what I thought might be important things to think about. This tangle where in the Sitter space. First of all, keep in mind, I think it's important to keep in mind that having the Sitter infinity in the future doesn't guarantee that you have it in the past and the other way around. So that's something that's sort of special to the Sitter and seems to differ from ADS and flat space. And another difference is that in the De Sitter space, it really makes a difference whether you take a global or a local, or let's call it causal, point of view. And I've argued that one way of taking that causal point of view that's sort of fairly general is to restrict to these causal diamonds. I've argued that the maximal observable entropy, whatever that means precisely, is bounded by 3 pi over lambda, the inverse cosmological constant, essentially, with sort of 2 different assumptions. Namely, if you take the global point of view, then it holds for all space times that are De Sitter, both in the past and future, while if you take the local point of view, or causal, I guess it's called, it holds for all lambda greater than zero spacetimes with suitable energy conditions. And you can then speculate, and I think Tom Banks will make a very compelling case for that on Thursday, I assume, that because of the universality of such an entropy bound that holds for all lambda greater than zero universes, that you may in fact associate with a particular value of lambda a particular dimension of a quantum Hilbert space of a theory. And that's this lambda n correspondence that he was the first to suggest. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Raphael. That's great.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, well, I'm just some elementary slides. I'm just talking.
I don't remember what I did.
How were you defining entropy to prove your bound?
Sorry?
What was your definition of entropy in proving your Hermitian entropy bound?
Right, so the best I can come up with is that if you specify an area, you can ask, how can I fill, how many different ways are there to fill out the interior of that area?
So tomorrow afternoon.
Okay, and by interior of the area, I actually mean light sheets of the area.
With
matter systems, how many different states can I put in there? How much information do I need to specify completely what's inside that area?
Okay.
So, for example, there could be a black hole in there, and you specify exactly its microstate, and...
Use the entropy of the maximal black hole you could stick inside here?
Well, not necessarily, because the space time might be of a type where I cannot put a black hole in. But
that's why I'm confused.
This relates to the question that Eva was asking me earlier already, which is, I mean, there's a problem. Most of the time what we do is consider situations where either I have a complete and isolated system that's passing through the light sheet, in which case, you know, I can probably calculate what the entropy of that system is, and then that refers to that entropy. In a situation where I'm in cosmology and I'm cutting through a system, and cutting through the space-time, and I might have matter everywhere, I think it's much more problematic. In most cosmologies, we can make a good approximation of entropy density, and basically a flux of entropy in the entire space-time, and then you just take the part that goes through the light sheet.
Okay.
But from a fundamental point of view, that's somewhat dissatisfying, I think.
So how do you calculate the entropy density?
The entropy density, I mean, for example, for a dust universe, it's basically the number of positions that a particle
So it's done case by case.
Yeah.
But in quote-unquote empty this inner space, there's supposed to also be an entropy.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I'm confused. Right. How can you prove a general bound if it's done case by case?
Well, in the case of, let's remember where this comes from. Okay, this was first formulated for isolated systems in flat space. Okay, where it was said that if I specify an area A, I cannot, there cannot be a system inside here which has an entropy larger than A. Okay, that's a very general statement. I haven't said anything about the macroscopic character of that system. I had a reason to believe that, and the reason was that I can always convert that system into a black hole.
Right.
And now, what has turned out to be possible is to generalize this formulation to spacetimes which are not asymptotically flat, mm-hmm. And that to the extent that you can calculate entropy well in them, mm-hmm. You can verify that this still works.
The assumption, the way you compute entropy, was that it would be dominated right. by a black hole.
The way you were asking the question, you were sort of saying, I don't know anything about the microscopic character of the system that's in here.
Well, I'm happy with macroscopic character, in the flat space case, black hole solutions might be taken.
In the flat space case, there's an argument that you can always sort of collapse a shell around here that will turn this thing into a black hole of the same area.
So
and therefore,
what's the analogous assumption that you're making in the general case?
To some extent, this is a much larger miracle to me, but it is still true that if I actually study examples where I can calculate entropy, and I check how much can I fit across a light sheet like that, I can saturate but not exceed this bound.
So you think there's a bunch of examples
right.
Right.
affecting this conjecture.
Right.
Okay,
so
in different examples you have different expressions for the entropy, and it so happens that this is always true.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't that a
Well, well proved is using very plausible assumptions on the relation between energy density and entropy density, that this is true, which basically saves you from checking a large class of counter examples. But his hypotheses are not in themselves something that we, you know, believe are physically deep statements, because, for example, the notion of entropy density is a phenomenological one, and you cannot really localize entropy arbitrarily well. So it's really more an elimination of counterexamples that you might have spent lots of time on. And in fact, there are examples where his conditions are violated, but where this bound still holds.
So when you say that the entropy is finite, some finite number of degrees of freedom, and say you draw a picture like this, so you have in mind roughly all of, you can describe all of the degrees of freedom by sort of stuff living on that slice, mm-hmm. sort of in accord with black hole complementarity, presumably a De Sitter complementarity,
yeah.
that tells you that somehow this stuff is equivalently coded over here.
Well, this is the point of view that Lubosch likes to take. I would like to completely eliminate talking about.
You say we're not even allowed to discuss that.
It's a meaningless region. I cannot give any meaning to any statements I make about it.
Black hole, right? You're also not talking about the interior of the black hole, which is.
Right. Doesn't it seem like if you're not trying to formulate the entropy of the empty space, you're asking how many ways can you form this empty space microscopically in a way that leaves this region exactly the same?
Right. Which counts the number of states in the other region, right?
Yeah. No.
And moreover,
because I'm not forming this region. I mean, what do you mean by forming?
In the black hole.
Yeah.
Well.
I mean, so what I have in mind is if you did have a way of making this from fundamental theory, then you ask how many ways can you make it so that it looks like this? So that there's some semi-classical limit in which this region looks like this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then. In this theory, you would be able to count the number of ways to do that.
But by make it,
since you're counting all the stuff that's out here.
But by
I think I'm agreeing with Lubosch, but I'm just asking.
I'm so confused, because if I have a fundamental theory, I would expect it to have states in it that correspond to regions of this form. So it might have e to the, 3 pi over lambda states in it that corresponds to regions of this form.
Yes.
But I'm not making any statements about what this means for.
Yeah, but that's an equivalent way of saying
about other parts of some abstract global spacetime that I can also draw from my relativity traditions.
Okay, but that's a completely alternative way of stating it, that you could be counting the number of states that look like vacuum everywhere here and have an arbitrary amount of stuff going on here. Right. And that's...
It should be logarithm of number of states, right? And now you say that all the states correspond to vacuum, which looks like a contradiction. There is one vacuum, at least how you used to, right?
Oh, I don't think so. If we have a horizon, we don't believe that there's only one state associated with that.
Well, I think we're not disagreeing. Everyone's saying the same thing.
Yeah.
You're just calling out a different thing, but we're all saying we're counting the number of ways to have this picture with no excitations over here.
So, for example, I could have a model in which the horizon is actually a membrane, okay, and the space ends there. And I would still say that there are e to the 3 pi over lambda different states of that membrane that make it look macroscopically all the same, namely, an empty De Sitter space. But I never make any reference to how that stands for states that are beyond the horizon.
I don't.
Michael, you have, here's your membrane, we're standing outside, and the S is the amount of, information content that I've tossed into the black hole. Same case. We're sitting out here. Number of states.
No. Steve, if I'm an outside observer, I don't ever toss anything into the black hole. There's stuff that settles on that membrane. I end up with a thermal-looking state, and then it starts coming out again. I don't talk about the interior of the black hole.
Come back out. That also corresponds to the fact that the entropy doesn't go below this invariant minimum. Right,
but it doesn't mean that if you fell into the black hole down here, you couldn't make it higher than entropy. For black holes. Entropy you measure as an outside observer could still be different than the number of states somehow inside the black hole that you would allow for.
Well,
yeah, okay, but these guys don't want to refuse to admit that there's sort of more entropy than the area computes. Okay, so let's,
yeah,
so let's take that
inside. That's fine, but not, but you would still not be able to make statements about the number of states
I mean, the question of whether you can okay, you're thinking about situations where from the inside observer's point of view, some miracle happens here, and instead of a singularity, you grow some baby universe, in which case you can have, you know, arbitrarily large entropy out there, and that's perfectly consistent with the holographic principle, actually. But
Who's
us guys?
Holographers like to
look
about that.
I have no. I mean, I personally think that it's a probably unphysical thing because you need negative energy.
But what is wrong with this point of view that we think of this as being like the region outside a black hole, and this is being like the region inside a black hole. And we can throw arbitrary amounts of stuff across the black hole horizon, so it's inside a black hole, and we're just counting the number of states.
But Steve, you know that things from inside a black hole don't come out, okay? So from the outside point of view, it's consistent for the following reason. It's consistent because you never see anything fall into the black hole. You just have some thing sitting there, which then starts to radiate and disappears again. You never need to refer to the inside of the black hole to understand anything that's going on there.
That is true.
Okay.
In this case, it's
and I think you
because
shouldn't.
Because de Sitter space does not decay.
Wait, I'm confused about that. Don't you have to understand why it's unitary even though it looks like you have a thermal spectrum, etc.?
Oh, well, no. That we understand because the calculation that gave us the thermal spectrum is an approximate calculation.
Okay.
And,
but what you say is the fault. You say
it's not really thermal. There are correlations and so on. I mean,
you say I make a big black hole, and it's going to sit around for a long time.
Yeah.
And I want to count of roughly how many states went in making that, okay, and that's the entropy. And then after a long time, it decays and all the energy comes back out, and I get all that information back, and it corresponds to the entropy, okay? Now, similarly, you could say the same thing here. Okay, I want a count of all of the, you know, stuff that went into making these other states, okay? And in this case, the one difference is there is no decay. I throw them all the, you know, I can build states over here, but
you can do it using
the
but it never decays down. Well, okay, aside from that is where you might get the this entropy back. But
that would be a system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom.
But in this case, so this is a count of the amount of stuff behind the horizon, the fact that it can never go below.
Let me give you the following analogy, and can we discuss this from a point of view of an analogy that I can give you?
Also doesn't like the analogy, so I admit that the horizon of the black hole is an objective quantity for everyone, but the horizon and the sitter depends on the observer, right?
Can I set up an analogy, and then you will tell me whether you think that's a good analogy to talk about for these questions, okay? Usually in scattering, I can have a matter system, and when it consists of different parts, I crash them together, I get a black hole, Schwarzschild black hole, it evaporates, I get that matter, and I can recover.
Good.
So if this is a pure state, this will be pure, and this will also be pure.
Okay.
Good. Now, let me take a matter system, such as the fantasy, which is in a pure state, and far away from it, a charged black hole, which is also in a pure state.
Yep.
Charged extremal black hole.
Good.
Okay, well, or near extremal, whatever, doesn't matter.
Yep.
I throw them together, I make a charged non-extremal black hole.
Yep.
Okay. And now, I wait for it to evaporate, and I get back some radiation, and an extremal black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I expect that I can describe these two things together as a pure state, okay,
together,
but not separately.
They're entangled.
Not separately.
They're entangled. Okay. Okay. Yep.
I would have thought that this is the de Sitter horizon.
That you throw into the black hole.
This is a black hole you start with. Okay, it's in a pure state and it's near extremal, or extremal, and you throw in some matter, you get a bigger black hole, and you get out radiation plus an extremal black hole again. In this process, you would expect that, you know, there's no way that you can completely extract the state of your total system by just looking at the radiation that's coming out. And I think that's sort of analogous to when I take a matter system and throw it into, you know, the smaller cosmological horizon, I get empty de Sitter space. Okay. And now once in a while I might have a big fluctuation in the thermal radiation, which, you know, gives me out an elephant.
But you have an entangled state between like this picture.
And I have a smaller de Sitter horizon again. Okay.
So it's true. Like that picture.
Good. You know, the only difference is that here the horizon is on all sides, so if you have thermal radiation, it will eventually fall again to the black hole, which means outside the horizon.
Well, this is why it's so rare. I mean,
it's stable, right?
But
this is just like that picture.
Good. So we're agreeing that this is a good analogy, but I don't understand why it is relevant. Okay, you were using arguments in which you were saying that it's very important that in de Sitter space, usually, you know, the horizon doesn't want to evaporate, or if it evaporates a little bit, you still are, you know, there's always some part left that is in the horizon.
There's some irreducible minimal number of degrees of freedom doesn't go away. Here determined by the charge, here determined by the cosmological constant.
Yes.
And that's how much stuff you can put into the black hole, basically, or how much information you can cram into the black hole is given by that number of degrees.
Right, but I can think of the black hole as from the outside point of view, it's just an object, it's a membrane or something that stores information.
An object that stores information. Yeah.
This is the object that stores the information. That's all that is. That's the membrane.
Well, okay.
I can't look at this.
Okay, you could either say from this point of view that, okay, this is what stores the information, and, you know, I'm interacting with it from the outside, by, you know, sending stuff into it and receiving it back. Or you could say, well, you know, if you had some microscopic description of the inside of a black hole, you might talk about looking.
We differ philosophically in that I think it doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about the states inside the black hole from the outside perspective because they can't get out anyway.
Okay. So similar story here. You might say you and I may have a different nuance about how we want to say it, but nonetheless, we would say one of the two following things, that you sort of send stuff in here, and you might want to say, well, it sticks to the horizon, however, and that this membrane